Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative medicine practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. This is the Natural Medicine Podcast and I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Joining us today is Gerald Quigley, a pharmacist and herbalist of great renown, and he's also on the scientific advisory board of PERDAS, a company dedicated to exploring the science and solutions around fertility issues in Australia. Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast, Gerald. How are you?
Andrew, I'm really well, and I do enjoy our chats, and congratulations for all you do in this segment, in this whole market. Communication skills, outstanding.
Thank you so much.
I've said all the good things, Andrew. Let's move.
Let's get down to business.
But seriously, I do enjoy our chats.
Well, thank you. Well, I've got to say I am blessed to have the opportunity to meet these incredibly inquisitive and expert minds, of which you are one. So welcome, mate. Now, let's talk fertility and women and couples, what they hope for and what they expect.
I'm a grandparent, and it's interesting watching the generations move along as I watch my children have families, and even within that age group, the changes in philosophy, in outlook, in attitude to having a family. My eldest had her two sons fairly early in her marriage. My youngest had her child at, I think she might have been 38 or 39. And the differences absolutely astound me in their expectations. The youngest expected that pregnancy would be easy. And of course, the longer you leave conception on both sides, both male and female, often the chances of successful pregnancies don't quite happen as they might have back, for want of a better term, in the old days. So now we have society, and that's the way we are. We have society now with these incredibly competent, busy, brilliant, intelligent women who establish a career and then probably look at an opportunity that's starting to escape them and they decide to have family. Now, that's really a perfect storm of things where you have an expectation that conception will be instant, within reason, and easy, and assuming that the partner is healthy and probably a similar age or perhaps older, over 40, where we've got all the issues with fertility health, that's a separate issue, probably being studied much more intensely now. So there is an ideal arena where education in this age group is very, very important to help them understand that preparation to conceive is more important than ever as you get a little older. And that means all those lifestyle factors that we've known for years, correct nutritional supplementation to address any insufficiencies which may be there. Those insufficiencies sometimes are identified, the easy ones, obviously, iron and other things, but there are many others that aren't. And for years and years and years, there's been general supplements, a bit of a scattergun approach available. But now the science, we're beginning to understand a lot more. And usually with the involvement of a dietitian or another practitioner or a naturopath or really anyone with an intense interest in this area, we can actually offer science-based explanations and science-based formulations that aren't magic. They're only part of the equation, but they are becoming over time a more and more and more important part of the equation. So that's how I see it at the moment. Now, whether that will change, whether as time goes by that expectation of family may come back earlier. I don't know. I don't think it will, because the pressures of two incomes and all the other things where that's just expected these days means that family will be delayed. And that puts, it's funny, but it puts pressure on that older generation, because then the grandparents become the de facto babysitters, which affects, and I see a lot of grandparents in my practice that say, we're worn out, we can't do it, but we actually don't have the courage to say anything. So it's gone, a little complicated.
Gone are the days when the grandparents could delight in their grandchildren, play with them, interact with them, connect with them, but give them back.
Well, often,
and I always remember that glib comment. So the great thing about it is you can give them back.
And them back not at the so end much. Of the day. No, not so much these days. No. But so, you know, all of that adds to the whole stress and planning. You know, if we have family, then what's the next step? When can I go back to work? All these other things have got to be considered, and that doesn't help. So that's, look, it's not as simple as it seems, but we're at least more aware of some of these challenges.
I'm going to ask you a bit of a medico-legal conundrum question here, and that is that seeing as we're seeing more and more couples being forced into, you know, is it the pressures of living now, of trying to, you know, achieve the Australian dream, but for whatever the reason, they're having children later and later in life. Is there a reasonable use for more targeted testing, laboratory assessments, even down to, say, genetic SNP testing in this age bracket of people, given that, you know, they may have underlying toxicants from, say, you know, being a welder or a builder with, you know, CCA, chromium, copper, arsenic, wood. Now it's changed, but, you know, you've got other pesticides in the wood now, which they're handling. So these sort of underlying toxicants, which at a younger age with our vitality, we wouldn't necessarily have a huge impact on creating a baby. But nowadays, with an aging population, maybe they do. What's your thoughts there? Over-testing?
I agree. And I think sometimes we go too far down the track with testing and we create unnecessary concerns. Again, a lot of my patients tell me that one of the most stressful times in their lives is presenting for a test and then waiting for an outcome, because almost the very concept of being tested implies there is an underlying issue.
Yeah.
That again adds to the stress. So we've probably got to draw a line in the sand. And for those people who do require far more care, we should have the facilities there. But I think to be generally available, probably you'd never get funding these days. And look, there's probably all sorts of things. But again, because in our generation, Andrew, we have all the genetic testing. These things, when we were first qualified as practitioners, genetic testing was probably done in cows and sheep, but it really wasn't ever done in humans. So we're learning a lot more. But do we overcomplicate all of that? If we can identify potential issues before conception occurs, that then probably is more comforting to a couple, rather than try when conception doesn't occur, we throw the kitchen sink at them trying to work out why this is not happening.
Right. So what you're saying is, for at least for some assessments, like, for instance, genetic SNP testing, possibly look at it earlier rather than later in life.
Yeah, maybe. But we're looking at hormone levels, and I think experts who I'm delighted to be associated with, like Leah Heckman, would say that sperm health is something that we've ignored for years and years and years. And she would say that an elementary test in any attempted conception, fundamentally, for the sake of usually the female partner, is a reassurance that at least we're shooting with live bullets, so to speak, because it often is an unexplained reason until everything else from one side's been exhausted, and then there's an attempt to try and find out on the other side. Why not blend them in, make the whole environment more comfortable with all the things we'll be talking about shortly, to make it a more wholesome and joyous experience rather than almost a scientific chore because we're throwing all these tests at them.
Given that it is the ovum, it is the female who chooses the sperm, it makes sense to make sure to ensure that the sperm are in tip-top condition so there's a greater selection for that ovum to choose from. So in line with that sort of premise, where does nutrition and where do supplements fit in?
Look, nutrition, whatever the so-called balanced diet is, I'm yet to discover. But there's no doubt that nutrition in so many ways, as with all the other lifestyle factors that we've all been brought up on expecting all of our patients to do, we've lost the plot in so many different ways because environmental toxins are playing such an enormous and usually unknown role. I'd love to know what environmental toxins, for instance, play in the development of autism. We're suspecting these things, but we're not sure. So We've got stressed couples in an environmentally toxic environment, probably, particularly if they drive a car or they work in a big city, eating things that are more convenient rather than in season. So the basics we've probably moved away from, throwing down the often inappropriately used supplement, expecting that that's going to solve all of their problems, and often an isolated supplement. We're now understanding more and more science. So let's look at food first. To be able to help a person understand that there's elementary things we need in our food chain, and it has been forgotten because we're bombarded constantly with food ads on television or in all media. The fast food industry has captured the world. We've got to somehow start with our kids at school to help them understand that good eating habits take time to develop and they are going to be the leaders of the future to help future generations. So we've got to regain that ground. From a supplement perspective, we can thankfully say now there's so much science available that we can have expertly put together combinations identifying the most common issues. So at least you get an opportunity to perhaps fill the gaps in that nutritional intake that may be there. However, as we know, there's no point of being 50 kilos overweight and taking aged garlic extract to reduce your blood pressure. It's just not like that. And we've got there's this pill for every ill and instant expectation that now has taken over completely. And it's shielding, I think, reality from a lot of couples who are trying to conceive. We've just got to get some basics, which means that it's not just the GP and it's probably not just the obstetrician, but it has to be often a dietitian or nutritionist. There has to be some, and that should be part of the team. And that should be funded. That team effort should be funded somehow. And I think it would reduce the impact of the health costs later if that happened. However, as you and I have been talking for so long, preventative strategies just don't seem to be understood at most government-funded levels.
Well, you know, let's look at what orthodox medicine calls preventative medicine, and it's not. It's not early intervention.
Yes, John.
That's what it is. So I don't know why they don't term it early intervention medicine because it sure as hell isn't preventative.
Yes, and I think if med students were taught that in their studies, they probably have a slightly different view on what reducing the risk of long-term illness and conception issues, as we're talking today, they probably get a better handle on it, I think.
So I take your point about lifestyle being so important. And if we think about stressors, not just toxicants, but also emotional stressors.
Of course.
And how they interplay with biochemistry. And so I do take your point that we really do have to get back to finding more appropriate ways to respond to the ever-increasing stressors in our life.
It's a big challenge, isn't it? Big challenge. I sit here having just come out of a one-hour yoga class, which I do three times a week. I have discovered yoga.
Yeah.
I find it relaxing. It's early morning, 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock. Great way to start the day, 3 days a week. And it really just helps you put things into perspective, because you start looking internally at how you can control your breathing, your emotions, your muscle tone, which sets you up for the day. The trouble is, as we know, no one's got time to scratch themselves, let alone it's probably a bit easier for me and maybe even for you. But when you're 30 and you've got a business career developing and your wife is running alongside you, either with you or running separately with her career, it's not quite as easy to find the time. So I think that we overcomplicate the whole issue by throwing too many things, because every single individual is different in their expectations, in their career pathways, in their ability to cope with stress. Some people ride along happily, but there's an ever-increasing number who are being dominated by stressful events, and COVID hasn't made it easy for anybody, particularly those who have been affected financially and emotionally and mentally and all these other things. And it's going to take us a long time to get out of this.
Yeah.
That adds to the equation.
But, you know, like I love that you're doing yoga now, but even things like, people think that it has to be a dedicated class, an hour long, and I haven't got that time. But what about spending just the next 5 minutes shutting down everything and listening, just listening for a bird, the sound, even if it's a motorbike, listening for whatever sounds your ears can pick up. And just that lack of concentration on the daily grind and being aware of, one preference of a sense. I remember years ago, these farmers and this husband and wife had the most beautiful relationship, and they used to dedicate a time in the afternoon. They came home and they used to spend some time, whatever time that was, lying on the floor with their arms outstretched in like a crucifix pose, just to relax muscles. Just to spend some time. And they almost had this sort of connection. Could have just been 5-10 minutes, but just that stop. Let's just stop for a second.
Previous generations, and of course we have to be responsible in discussions with alcohol, but previous generations would have called that their sherry time, where they just actually for 10 minutes at 5:30 had a little time together. Now that's impossible these days. No one has time to do that. I, for one, and I'm well past reproduction time, but I, for one, try and have 10 minutes doing just that, and I call it resting my eyes time, where I just turn everything off, sit on a lay-back chair. I set an alarm, otherwise I'd probably just drift off forever. But I do find just that 10-minute break from everything in the afternoons really, really, really good. But how would you apply that rationale to those two busy executives who decide, let's have a baby, let's have a child? And you'd love to be listening in to how they try and put that jigsaw puzzle together, that if we have a baby, what will you contribute? What will you contribute? What will grandma contribute on either side? And there's all these things that probably in a previous generation, when children were conceived in the 70s, that we never thought of that. I mean, it just didn't enter your mind. It was just you had a child and you enjoyed them, and then life got back to normal.
Yeah. Well, normal.
Normal. Yeah, well, yeah, of course. Well, it's only the first 30 years, really, isn't it?
That's exactly right. A mere blink.
So it is, but we've got to just help. And this is where a practitioner is so important, where it's not a clinical discussion of a problem. It's to help them understand that there are others around who can guide and advise. But let them make the decisions rather than tell them. And I think we as health practitioners often do too much telling and not enough listening and advising.
Salient point. So we mentioned a couple of nutrients before, but let's talk about iron, because this is a massive issue. And I've got to say, I've changed my tune with iron. I am so concerned that back in my day, as we've glibly said, we knew that it was like one in eight, 12% of women who had iron deficiency anemia. But now I was quite rather surprised. In fact, I thought surely that's incorrect. But on the Per Day's website, it says one in four women have inadequate iron intake. And I went, nah, can't be right. That's got to be a typo. So I went searching. And, of course, that was backed up. My assumption was confirmed by older medical advice. But then I looked at the Australian Bureau of Statistics and their most recent dietary health survey, and sure as hell, there's this one in four. I am so concerned. I even looked at the graph. I was looking at it this morning. And if you look at a certain age bracket, the reproductive age bracket, so women aged a little bit younger, I get it, age 14 to 50, but in that major segment of reproduction, that spikes to 40% of women having insufficient iron intake. Mm. What the heck is going on here?
I think it starts in the in schools these days, where one of the stronger girls in class says, right, I think we should all be considering animals, and I don't think we should be eating iron because that contains meat and it's cruel and all these things. And that's fine. Let them have a view. However, I am staggered at how many inquiries I get from very concerned parents whose children, invariably girls, have said, right, no iron, thank you. I'm not eating iron. I'm going to be a vegetarian. And that's okay. But it has to be backed up with some advice to fill in the gap that that iron insufficient intake is causing. And those gaps are astoundingly important, from red blood cells production to concentration to emotional development to mental health. So where do we intervene at that to make sure that as time goes by, we're maintaining our levels? And it staggers me completely that kids these days can get so swept along by a cause rather than really perhaps listen to mum and dad or listen to someone else that might say, I understand, that's fine. Let's not have meat 5 nights a week. Let's have red meat 2 or 3 nights a week. And you get to choose the meat. What's your favourite? Do you want lamb? Do you want this? Do you want that? And we're going to increase our intake of green leafy vegetables as well. And we're going to do these other things. So we need to make sure that your iron and our iron intake is maintained. So the stats don't surprise me. I think that will probably now be pretty well set in concrete. I don't think that will change. Hopefully it won't get any worse. And there again, because of the fast food, because of lifestyle, because of all these things. Are you surprised at that? You expressed a little bit of surprise, but when you look at the modern science, I'm not surprised at all.
Mm. I have a thought here, and that is that one of these big issues is that people get a concept in their mind without the knowledge of the ramifications of what that means.
Sure.
And I have met vegans who manage their diet and their intake so well.
Yes.
They are glowing. They are glowingly healthy.
Yes.
But they manage it and they know. They don't think they know. They know their iron and their folate intake is acceptable because they'll test or they'll ensure that they're not running into any issues. And that, you know, is sort of their, not necessarily their barometer, but a guide at Wiles to say, yes, this is correct for me. This is doing its job.
And that's go ahead.
Are we getting to the stage in our civilization? I get this is heading towards Brave New World, but are we getting to the stage where we really need to be looking at some laboratory parameters early in life? Do we require blood tests in children?
Someone's got to pay. That's the problem. It all comes back to funding. Good. And we test for lots of complicated things, but we don't probably test enough for those nutrients. And I get inquiries about how do I find out how much magnesium I've got? Well, you just ask your GP next time you're there. oh, can I do that? Really, I didn't think that was possible. So there's a lot of education to go on. And again, that helps. There are many people that take magnesium that still find and show signs of magnesium insufficiency because they're either taking the wrong magnesium or it's not being absorbed at all. And that happens with iron. It happens with a lot of the nutrients. Mm-hmm. So testing there would help establish clear guidelines, and perhaps in the conception space, there would be elementary tests done to set a bar, and that might happen 6 months before a planned conception. So you can say, okay, these are the little gaps we've got. Here are the options we've got. Let's discuss them and put them into place, and then we can retest in 6 months' time to make sure we've filled in those gaps. It seems perfectly logical, but again, it takes personnel, it takes time, it takes organisation, and the health system, in my opinion, in Australia, is just slowly disintegrating. So the rest of us have probably got to pick up the reins and start talking to people who make decisions. Sadly, that means politicians, which is a challenge, but hopefully we've got a couple of health-centric politicians in power who might represent the average Aussie in a different light. So it's a complicated issue, but at the end of the day, we're trying to offer evidence-based guidelines to achieve the most successful outcome and a happy outcome for a person or a couple who would like to conceive. And it's really all about putting everything together. It takes the organisational skills that I don't think are about at the moment.
Yeah. So just getting back to iron for a second, and that is that intake. Is the answer giving them a high-dose iron supplement?
No, it's not, because what happens, Andrew, is that the iron supplement usually causes all sorts of gut issues, and it's after a few weeks, most people say, I can't do it. So there are iron combinations that are well formulated. There are others that have been around for a long time that aren't so well formulated. Again, that's where advice from a practitioner is very, very important. Sometimes iron orally is not absorbed at all. There is now a lot more tendency to insist on an iron infusion. They are a lot more medically accepted now and can be arranged in a GP practice. So that, again, there are negative attitudes towards understanding from a patient perspective that an iron infusion is really nothing more than just lifting levels to where they should be to perhaps be maintained by a gut-friendly supplement. But loading up, which still happens in GP land, loading up with a high-dose supplement is usually counterintuitive. It doesn't work, and it just usually creates more tension and more concern by the person who's affected. So I often say, have a discussion with your GP about an iron infusion, it's amazing that the results are quite spectacular normally.
I was quite surprised that naturopaths have been talking about the facility of using lower dose iron supplements on a regular basis instead of the high dose sulfate-based iron preparations, which tend to bounce down the gut.
Cool.
But I was also reading about the body's response to high-dose iron intake, is that the body's response to that challenge is to make a molecule called hepcidin, yes, which deliberately and pointedly blocks iron absorption. So the whole point of taking a regular high-dose iron supplement is nullified. And interestingly, even the Royal Australian College of GPs, which is the article was espousing, as you mentioned, the use of intravenous infusions, and that they're a lot safer these days for those with precipitously low iron. But for those who haven't got a really low iron, it's actually better to take either a high-dose supplement irregularly or, better, a low-dose supplement regularly.
There's got to be some structure to help educate people that iron is very important. Certainly there are those who genetically have excess levels of iron, and I've got some friends like that who throw up their hands and say, but they still enjoy a steak, they still enjoy all those things. But the majority of people just need some help to understand that the role of iron is fundamental. And in pregnancy especially, it plays very, very important roles in the fetal development and in the mum's health. So it's a no-brainer. But we expect, sadly, as we mentioned earlier, that you've got the identified insufficiency, you take the pill, and in 4 weeks it's going to be back to normal. It's not like that, because the human body actually doesn't like being pushed around and having excess things thrown at it. And as you said, just puts up the barrier straight away and says, no, not for us.
So let's move on to other nutrients. What is it? Since January 2010, there's been a guideline, a National Health and Medical Research guideline, that all pregnant women should receive 150 micrograms of iodine in a supplement, yes, as well as us having iodine fortified food and iodized salt and things like that. They're actually advocating a supplement pointedly for pregnant women. We know that folate, not necessarily folic acid, folate and B12 are intrinsically linked to fertility health. How important are these? What sort of comments have you got to make?
They, again, are fundamental. And we're talking about the main ones here. And there's a number of others that are sometimes included in these formulations. But we know that, and I think it was our colleagues at Blackmores who many, many, many years ago did a patient survey down the eastern seaboard of Australia of iodine levels in pregnant women. And I remember it well because Tasmania weren't included, and they got very antsy about the fact that they weren't included, as often happens down to Tasmania. And that's why it stuck. But they showed then that most Australian women of childbearing age had low levels of iodine. Mm-hmm. And that's why even in those days, a number of the prenatal supplements started including iodine as part of the general range. So, yes, iodine, even in thyroid formation, plays a big role there. So, again, we can be comforted by the fact we've got the science. We're now formulating things to strict scientific values, and the better companies are actually have experts working. So it's not just a willy-nilly which perhaps might have happened in the old days. It's a scientifically formulated team effort to make sure that the most identifiable insufficiencies can be addressed in a gut-friendly way without making things too complicated. So all we're doing is filling the gaps, Andrew, and hopefully that will even get better as time goes by. But we're pretty good at the moment.
What about the changing science of not just ingredients, the newer forms of folate, ubiquinol versus ubiquinone? We know about these. Australia now has the facility to use mecobalamin, the methyl cobalamin, rather than the cyanide-containing cobalamin. Just newer formulations, but also presentation, also the way that companies are looking at helping their patients. Not from a marketing perspective, but more about a useful perspective in something as critical as fertility. What sort of changes have you seen with regards to formulation, packaging, presentation, even of the product itself?
The most exciting development I've seen is a capsule within a capsule concept, which is called NutraSeal. And this basically, because we know so much more about gut health and the role of the brain-gut connection and all the ramifications that pathway works over time every day, we know that there are various factors that can affect a person's ability to absorb or not absorb particular nutrients. So the concept of protecting certain nutrients from, for instance, gastric acid, really is very appealing. So this NutraSeal concept has meant that a solid formulation can be delivered in almost a protected form. It's almost wrapped to make sure that absorption occurs in various parts of the digestive system. So We're trying to make sure that the expectations are fulfilled based on the science. And this technology has been quite brilliant. I'm not sure where it started, but the concept of it, I think, is making a big difference in a person's ability in all the challenges about absorption at the moment that we see. It's now making a difference. So that's probably the most exciting thing I've seen for a while.
I was impressed, just looking at the Purdey's website, I was impressed by this double glass wall packaging.
Yes.
Because as we know, plastic breathes. I was so impressed when I saw that. I thought, that's really thoughtful. That's a really nice little concept.
Everyone expects, Andrew, that the supplement, when you open the bottle that you first take, will be exactly the same strength as the one at the bottom of the container.
Yeah.
And little issues like this are just making sure that, in fact, those expectations are met all the way through. So you've got solid formulations protected all the way through the digestive tract, presented in a almost a protective shell again to make sure that they're as potent at the time of purchase as they are at the time of manufacture.
That's really so. If you think about that, that's really addressing that ethical responsibility to patients. And I use that term differently to the word customers.
Mm.
These are patients who require our care.
Yes.
And you have an ethical responsibility to do everything in your power to fulfill that care to your best ability.
And I think, Andrew, even more, that there are these patients are brittle and fragile and concerned and full of that joy and expectation, which, if it isn't fulfilled in a reasonably short term, causes all of those previous things I've mentioned to actually become almost toxic within the relationship. So there's stresses everywhere and often from outside as well. So the more we can offer these individuals, it gives them greater quality of life, and it just helps set things in the right way. But it involves education. It involves more than ever informed and educated practitioners who give advice on a scientific basis that is easy to understand and reassuring for those people. So forget about all the technology. It's all about helping that person understand, to get the engagement and to make sure they follow some simple instructions. And if they fall off the perch, we put them back on and we just get them back on the rails again. So it's a team effort, and it really is a privilege to see this whole exciting area develop so well.
Well, indeed, it is a team. And I've got to say, I have always admired you for the way that you have shown patients these practical ways to achieve success in whatever their ailment is over the many years that you've been around. And but also, you know, the responsible care that, as you mentioned before, Leah Heckman, that this true core responsibility to that patient. I'm in great admiration of you both, and indeed Purdey's, for having the foresight to engage with people like you to help patients along their journey to creating a successful family, a beautiful family.
Well, we feel privileged to be involved as well. And the exciting thing is it just makes you feel good at the end of the day when you think, you know, we might have made a difference somewhere along the line. And that's what, as parents and grandparents and human beings, we're all trying to do to each other.
Well done, Gerald. Thanks for taking us through this today. It's been wonderful chatting to you, as always. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Remember, you can catch up on all the show notes on your favourite podcast app and, of course, on the Natural Medicine Partners website. I'm Andrew Whitfield-Cook. This is Natural Medicine Podcast.